This is Rebecca Lowe, or Rebecca Lua, if you listen to Suboptimal Radio, and you are listening to Men in Blazers on the NBC Sports Network.
It's unbelievable!
Welcome to a Men in Blazers International Break podcast special. An international break which gives us a chance I've wanted for a long time, to bring onto the pod the remarkable Raphael Honigstein, the Bavarian-born, London-based writer and broadcaster who is, amongst other things, the Premier League correspondent for German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung and German football correspondent for The Guardian. Raphael is also the author of the recent, quite brilliant book, Das Reboot, How German Football Reinvented Itself and Conquered the World, a beautifully written chronicle of the overhaul of the nation's footballing system that took it from the dark doldrums of the early 90s to 2014, when they built an imperious World Cup winning national team squad, and also half of our US team too. I love the book for many reasons, not least that it's impossible to read without thinking deeply of American youth development, coaching, and national team infrastructure. It's honestly a must read for any American who wants to think deeply about where our own nation is headed and where it can go. Welcome to the pod, Mr. Raphael Honigstein.
Hello.
Oh, it's good to speak to you. You are the London-based columnist for The Guardian. English is your second language, yet you're one of my favourite bylines in the media. When you wrote this book, in your head, did you write it in English or in German?
No, I did write it in English, and English is actually very useful for writing, because unlike German, which is very structured and rigid, as you'd expect it to be, you don't necessarily have to know where the sentence ends before it starts, because English grammatically is so flexible, you can do all sorts of stuff. In German, it doesn't work like that. So in a way, it was easier to write. The problem was that all these interviews were, of course, conducted in German, so I had to translate them and then write it, which made it a bit more arduous. But yeah, it was cool writing in English, I must say.
You put those of us that are meant to be first language English writers to shame. And those interviews, they range from, I mean, fantastic interviews. Per Mertesacker with Müller, a lot of time spent with Jürgen Klinsmann that we will talk about. But the book, I loved it. It's a journey from 1990, where a triumphant Franz Beckenbauer, one of my favourite quotes, not from Pelé's mouth, but about as accurate as one of Pelé's quotes, when you won the World Cup in 1990, what did he say to the world?
He said, now with the East Germans coming into the national team as well, we'd be unbeatable for years to come. In fact, we proved very beatable for years to come.
Right after he said that, German football just bottomed out, hit a nadir, became known for its drab, uninspired functionality. And your book tells the story of how the German footballing system, the league, the national teams, the youth development transformed itself strategically all the way to 2014, the thrashing of Brazil and the subsequent World Cup victory. Of all the elements of the revolution you analyse, Raphael, which do you believe proved to be key?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. Obviously, it's a mosaic. I also write in the book about the way that football was and is now being talked about and written about in the media. I think that has a huge impact on how football is actually understood and then eventually played. But if you ask me about one single sort of most important fact, I would say it is the quality and quantity of young players coming through. I think what we found at the early noughties, you know, the worst time of all is that people put forward lots of different reasons why German football wasn't doing so well. And it's the sort of stuff you hear people say in the pub with a beer in their hands late at night. And people sort of nods and say, you know, these guys make too much money. They spend too much time on the PlayStation. They don't play in the street anymore like we used to do or our forefathers used to do. They are not patriotic enough. They don't want it enough. All this stuff, all this noise, I would call it, which is absolutely totally irrelevant at the end, because the only thing that matters, and Germany took a long, hard view in the mirror and had to sort of understand that point and then and face up to the consequences. All that really matters is the quality and the number of good players you produce. If you produce 40, 50 really good players, chances are you're going to find 11 that will have a decent shot at any tournament going forward. That's where Germany are right now. but it took them a long time, as you said, to get to that point.
I mean, this is why I loved your book. I mean, I loved it for the German narrative, but it's almost impossible to read it without thinking about the parallel conversation going on right here, right now, in the United States about these similar issues: youth development, the training system, the player pool, the quality of the talent we're developing. And of course, it all leads to Jurgen Klinsmann, who's overseeing this whole system here based on a key role that he played in the German Revolution. But the strategy I was most fascinated by the conversation in your book, and I think the one that many of our listeners will love, is the emphasis on youth development, the investment in coaching, Raphael. In 2000, Germany had about 100 full-time pro coaches. Today, there's over 400 full-time coaches who think only when they get out of bed until they go to sleep of training kids.
That in the end makes a big difference. I mean, the overall number, funnily enough, of German players playing football hasn't changed so much. You have 6 million Germans playing football, 180,000 of them play at a reasonable standard. But that was exactly the same as you had 25 years ago. So the difference is just that these guys are now being better coached. More coaching, better quality coaching, and also a system whereby when you're 16, 17, and you're not quite sure, you know, am I good enough to be a pro, or do I have to go to college? What am I going to do? You no longer have to make that choice at that moment in time. If you're middle class, or if you're just very bright and you want to stay in school as long as possible, because the coaching and the way that the schools work are streamlined for the best players, you can stay right until you do your A-levels and basically your degrees that allow you to go to university, which opens up a whole new demographic and which makes it so much easier for these kids, A, to stay in school, but also to persist with the football. They don't have to say at 16, 17, you know, I'm not quite sure, I'll leave that football aside because it's too much training, I can't do my A-levels. What they really, the German FA, what they managed to fix is take that big question out of the equation. It's no longer an either or, you can do both.
Yeah, I mean, you said the number of players has not changed, but there's a line in your book, you said the net effect was to develop a pool of players at 18 who'd enjoyed, and this statistic is amazing, they'd enjoyed between 50% to 100% more training sessions as kids than the previous generation. Elite players working with elite full-time coaches, emphasis on both aspects there, 3 to 4 times a week, every week. And probably just as importantly, finding the balance between kind of stiff coaching versus free play and street ball.
Yeah, I mean, all these things are absolutely crucial. I think what football has found, certainly over the last 10 years, is that training has become a lot more individualistic. You know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to have one group of players doing the same thing, whether they are centre-backs or wingers or, you know, midfielders or playmakers or strikers. But in order to give them the individual training that they need, you just need the coaches. There was always a great fear, and Jurgen Klopp actually said that in one of the old interviews I dug out. There was always this great fear in Germany of having stuff that's not fun in training. You know, the coach's biggest fear was to have like 20 players just standing around and looking at him, explaining something, and they're all getting cold and they're all bored and they want to go home. But unless you have the numbers, you know, the numbers of coaching staff to keep everybody busy and to have exercises that get everybody involved, it's a very difficult transition to make. And I'm not sure, you know, about that 10,000 hour people sometimes put forward for talent, but it certainly does come at one level. It does come to the numbers of hours spent on the ball doing football things, and that's definitely changed. And I can tell you, they used to, even in my, when I was growing up, kids would just go sent on endurance runs, you know, 3 hours every week. And it, because the idea was, you know, that you will win because you can run more than your opponent. And maybe that's not completely wrong, but of course it came to the detriment of actual technical development. In 2000, 2002, 2004, Germany looked at teams with much fewer numbers of players, the Dutch, the Czech Republic. And so, you know, these guys, they can run as much as we do. Technically, they're probably better than we do because they spend more time doing the stuff that we don't think is necessary for us as Germans. And and they can do all the stuff that we can do. So, you know, we need to go back to basics. And for a country like Germany, it was very hard to admit that to itself. But once they did, and I think you'll find that in the book, none of it is really that amazing and that innovative. It's kind of, once you're on the right path, the next thing almost follows logically. And in hindsight, you're thinking, well, of course, you know, why didn't we think about that earlier?
Oh, the endurance runs, Raphael. You're bringing back many, many truly miserable childhood memories. And I think that it's 10,000 hours in America is the number, but it's 10 hours in England that leads to greatness. And another big discovery from the book, German football had become thoroughly middle class, and that needed to change. US soccer is also still thoroughly middle class. What did German football do to transform itself?
Well, actually, the middle class is where we are now, and that was the big transformation. We started at a point where about 15% of a youth team, or even later in the Bundesliga team, would be people with A levels. Everybody else would have dropped out of school at 16, saying, "I'm good enough to be a footballer. I don't need to go to school anymore." Now it's turned on its head. Now you'll have 15% of people dropping out at school at 16. The other 85 stay in school, get really good degrees, and as a result, pretty bright, you know, on average. And the reason for that is, as I alluded to earlier, is A, it's easy enough for these guys to do both things. That wasn't possible before because of the school system. But perhaps more interestingly, talking to youth coaches, what they're saying is the game has become so complex and so intellectually demanding when it comes to formation, when it comes to things you have to do, different tactical systems you need to be able to switch, you need to be able to understand, that the people who are less proficient above the waistline sort of almost naturally tend to get left behind now. That's where German football is at the moment. And I think it's being reflected in, if you look at a German team and you look at these guys and you listen to them in interviews and you see how they behave on the pitch, this is a very different German team, very different to most football teams you see, at least in Europe. And I think overall, it's been very beneficial for us.
But you did also start to dig down and become a team of hybrid identities within that national team setup. To begin with, Germany, I mean, they'd just let possible dual nationals walk into the Turkish team, players like Ümit Davala, İlhan Mansız. But there was a decision to actively change that and to recruit heavily. I mean, it's something that's going on in US soccer right now with Mexican Americans, Colombian Americans. We love German Americans here, Raphael, Norwegians. In fact, Sami Khedira said, "Of course, we noticed it's something new to have German national players with Turkish, Ghanaian, Nigerian or Tunisian roots, but for our generation, it's become very normal." How profound a change, how strategic a change was that for Germany?
Well, it was definitely profound. Strategic, I'm not sure. I think they woke up to the error of their ways in 2002 when that Turkish team with six or seven players born in Germany took Turkey to the semi-finals at that World Cup. And what they did at that point, I think, was to say, let's make it harder for the best players to turn us down. Let's really try and get the Mesut Özils of this world to play for us. And I don't think they necessarily sort of started targeting players the way the Turkish FA, for example, target players. They have an own office in Germany doing nothing else but looking for German-born players with Turkish roots who can play for Turkey. But they just sort of made themselves more open, said, let's make sure that these type of guys who maybe not from the usual background, from the way it used to be, feel just as happy playing in a white shirt than the Müllers and the Schmidts, etc. And I think that was mentally a big change. And of course, it fit beautifully with that new wave of a very different kind of very non-threatening, very positive, very inclusive patriotism that then came through in 2006, because that really paved the way for people thinking about the German national team in a different way, and also different kind of people being quite happy to sing the national anthem. This is something that will be sounding very alien, I think, to American listeners, but in Germany, growing up after the Second World War, you were almost taught to sort of say, patriotism, waving the flag, not really for us. You know, it can be easily misunderstood, can easily drift into chauvinism, into jingoism. Let's leave that aside. Let's take pride in our constitution. Let's take pride in democracy, but leave the flag and all that aside. And because 2006 was such a huge success and people became so happy and comfortable with rooting for Germany in both senses of the world, things changed. And that also made it easier then for the likes of Özil, Khedira, Gomez, etc. to feel truly German despite having a different surname.
You tell so many remarkable stories in this book. One that I most loved was that of Christian Guttler and his football machine. I don't know what the football machine is in German, Raphael, but you've got to describe it, because I can't believe that every city in America doesn't have one of these babies.
Well, they're quite expensive. I mean, the football knout is his invention. It's basically a room, a bit like a holodeck in Star Trek, but actually real, with the ball coming at you at four different directions. Goodloe is a musician by trade, and he said, you know, the problem with football is you can't train the stuff you do every day. If you play on the pitch and you mislay a pass to a certain guy, you cannot repeat it on the pitch. The ball might not go back to you for the next 10 minutes. And how can you develop a system where you can actually do the same thing over and over, and but also measure your success in that? And he came up with that football robot, or room really, where a ball comes at you and then quadrants light up. It's very futuristic, very Tron, very, very cool to play in. I've tried it myself. And then you have to dispatch the ball as quickly as you can into the right quadrant. And just playing it at my very average or below average level, amateur level, for a couple of minutes just shows you how demanding it is on you, not so much on your legs, even though it is a bit of a workout, but actually on your brain. It is hugely unnerving and hugely stressful to have the time constraints and the pressure to execute these things correctly with very small margins of error. And that is something that Ralf Rangnick, who is a fantastically interesting German coach, talked to me about, where he said the next big advances that we'll see in football will not come, in his view, from tactics or from physical improvements, because he thinks the limits are being hit there. It'll come from cognitive ability and the ability to react quicker in your head to things happening. And the football now is exactly the sort of thing. It hones your technique, but it also hones your ability to execute really difficult moves under real pressure. And of course, when Mario Götze scores his goal, Mario Götze having trained in this thing at Dortmund for hours and hours by himself on Sunday nights, or sometimes with Marco Reus after training, it's a football now goal that wins the World Cup. And it's just a beautiful ending to that particular story, and something that, you know, might not happen to everyone playing in the football now. Certainly not the people at Hoffenheim, who also have one. But I think it shows you just another creative idea, I think, that Germans and German football came up with, to just say, let's try a bit harder. Let's get that edge back that we used to have.
I want a football now in every American city, including you, Columbus, by about 2018. I've got to get to this. One of the key characters in your book, Jurgen Klinsmann. I've read your byline for a long time, Raphael, and at times, particularly after the Bayern Munich coaching spell, you've been quite dismissive of Jurgen as a manager in the past. But in this book, more than anything else, it feels like you found, is this fair to say, a retrospective, a deep appreciation for him?
For his work at Germany, for sure. 100%. I think the stuff he did had such a long-lasting impact that, and such a profound impact that you could only really see it in 10 years after the event. I think 2014, with Germany coming up against the USA, Klinsmann against Löw in Recife, brought a real opportunity to everybody to take stock. And what people, even taking a sort of a very superficial look back, found immediately is that a lot of stuff that was hugely controversial at the time, revolutionary, foolhardy, whatever you want to call it, had become the absolute normal gold standard business practice in German football. And there already at that point, you have to say, you know what, a lot of stuff that he used to get a lot of criticism for turned out to be very, very smart. I think the problem that I had with him at Bayern was that he didn't have a Jogi Löw at his side to do the details, to do the tactical stuff, working with the players on a daily basis. Klinsmann is somebody that I've described in the past as a project manager, somebody with really big, huge ideas, but he relies on the people below him to implement them. And in Löw, he had a fantastic guy. It was the perfect double duo, almost a good cop, bad cop kind of setup. And at Bayern, he didn't have that. He had Vasquez, who had no idea about German football or European football at all.
Martin Vasquez, who was the assistant coach at the US until right before the World Cup.
Yeah, and you know, one Bayern insider told me that, you know, they used to go to a stadium and Vasquez would stand there and say, "Wow, 60,000, unbelievable. You know, he seemed a bit overawed by the whole thing, and I don't think it worked out, and the players were very, very unhappy with the coaching that was being done. But even at Bayern, and this is another thing that took maybe a few years to filter through, some of the stuff he did when it came to sorting out the club HQ, if you want, the place where the players hang out, the place where the players train individually, meeting rooms, etc. He had a lot of good ideas, and a lot of stuff was kept by the people who followed him. So in terms of infrastructure, if you want, he also had a positive impact on Bayern, even though it was limited because he didn't spend so much time there. But I think as somebody who drove through change at the top, not the bottom, because he had nothing to do at all with youth development in Germany, at the top, when it came to changing the way the national team played, changing the way things were done, the way the national team was organized, he was absolutely 100% successful and hugely, hugely influential. And I think we can only just be grateful that the German FA was so desperate that they went to him after everybody else who was even sort of half successful and had a name had turned them down. It was a huge opportunity for somebody from the outside, literally from coming in from the other half of the world, from the end of the world, from California, changing things, and he did change things.
But wow, did the German media absolutely destroy him. The German game's incredibly political. He was an easy target jetting in from California. Bild called him Grinsey Clinsey, and they wrote that he smiles haughtily while wreaking havoc with the German World Cup dream. I mean, your analysis of why he was so pilloried is really beautiful to read. He wrote, "German heroes were doers, not thinkers. Asking questions and being introspective was despised by many Germans." And you wrote, "there'd been a near total lack of introspection within the game, which was not simply informed by arrogance. It was a deliberate psychological ploy. Doubts diminish total confidence."
Yeah, I mean, that's how German football was being thought about and talked about. You know, you didn't want to start questioning yourself. You didn't want to say, you know what, maybe we're not doing things right, because all these things were seen as weakness and as somebody sort of raising the white flag and rolling over and doing all the things that we shouldn't be doing. And he really started from the point of, let's look at everything, let's leave no stone unturned and start again. And, you know, an organization like the German FA, hugely set in his ways, hugely political. I mean, he was a bull in a china shop, and he destroyed a lot of plates along the way and put a lot of noses out of joint. But it was necessary. A lot of people needed to be fired. A lot of things needed to be changed. And Oliver Bierhoff, the general manager of the team, the guy who works below him when it comes to organization, when it comes to dealing with sponsors, setting up training camps, etc., he was hugely influential, because he was facing all these angry people from the FA and having to do, you know, the PowerPoint presentation saying, why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? While Klinsmann was back in LA in Huntington Beach. And the two of them really have changed the national team and have changed it for the better.
Oh, that phrase, doubts diminish total confidence, as someone that only has doubts and is riddled by self-loathing, I just find that phrase just absolutely fantastic. But the level of change that you mentioned, it was remarkable that he brought in. That there's lines about him bringing in athletic consultants who taught the players, and these were not just players, these were the best players in Germany, the hardened professionals considered world class. He taught the players that, quote, acceleration comes from the biggest and strongest muscles, the buttocks. And so the players had to learn to run differently and to be faster and more powerful. Raphael, these players were all professionals. They were all successes. Many of them were playing in the greatest leagues in the world. Not all of them could have taken well to being told they had to run from their buttocks. Some of them must have resisted.
Yeah, of course. Some of them did. Loads of them did. I mean, what Klinsmann had going for him was the World Cup. So even those who didn't quite buy into his revolution said, okay, I'll have to toe the line here because I want to play. I want to play in 2006. The thing that sometimes is not well understood, I think, by fans is that national manager has, in a way, more power than a club manager, because the club signs a player, the player's there, he's on a huge contract. It's very difficult as a manager to do anything about that if you're not happy. National manager can really shape the team. He can't buy anyone, which is another problem, but he, of course, can get people to toe the line more effectively because otherwise they're out. And Klinsmann used that really well. And the older people who didn't quite buy into it that much toed the line. And the younger ones, I think, by and large, said, you know what have we got to lose? We might have been taught it differently. We might have never seen that before. But this guy is a World Cup winner. He's a European winner. He's the last guy who lifted a trophy in Germany in 1996 at the Euros. And he's played all over the world. Maybe he knows what he's talking about. Let's give him a chance. But the media, and especially those people sort of in positions of power who'd been around for hundreds of years, you know, the people dominating the airwaves, the old pros, they're all looking at him thinking, you must be joking. I mean, an American trying, I mean, they sort of almost saw him as an American, you know, American trying to tell us.
They saw Jürgen as an American.
Yeah. Because, you know, he was talking like one. He was bringing in American ideas. He was bringing in American personnel. And Germans thought, you know, what is happening here? Here's a guy taking over our football. And we don't really want it. We don't really like what he's doing. We don't really understand what he's doing. And then when results go badly against you, and Italy, the friendly in March 2006,
4-1.
Was the key game. 4-1 defeat in Florence. I mean, Germany tend to lose against Italy anyway, but to be 4-1 3 months before, in a manner where the German team were absolutely destroyed by playing really attractive attacking football and getting counter-attack taken apart on the break every time by the Italians. People thought, you know what, this is going to be an absolute disaster.
It wasn't just people, Raphael. After that 4-1 defeat 3 months before the World Cup, the German parliament had serious debate about whether they should call in Jürgen Klinsmann, football manager, for a government hearing. How close to getting fired was Jürgen?
He was very close, very close. I think in the end, the US saved him because the US lined up for friendly a couple of days later, or a week later after that Italy game. And if I remember correctly, it wasn't an official FIFA date, so some of the best players weren't around. So they effectively beat a B team from the US quite comfortably. And that bought him a bit more time. But yes, I mean, you picked up the big tabloid Bild, who hated him anyway. And every single day you had somebody else saying, you know, he has to go. We need to put somebody in charge, anybody in charge. We need to play with a sweeper system. I mean, people were just saying, you know, let's just turn the clock back. Because, you know, 2002, we weren't very attractive. We were quite negative. We were very reactive. But you saw we're still tough to beat. And it got us to the final. Let's do that again. Klinsmann said no. And thankfully, even though we didn't win, we won. Or we came as close to winning as possible with this team. Thankfully, he rolled out that storm.
If you would have had Bruce Arena, you might well have won it, Germany. But the 2006 World Cup, what a footballing story. Germany, young Germany, winning the hearts of the world, a buccaneering run, and a brilliant team into the semi-final. The nation, delirious, self-confident, and then out in the semi-final stage. And Jürgen Klinsmann says in your book, he said a lot of Germans felt it was better that the team lost in the semi-final, that a better Germany was actually projected by losing.
Yeah, well, I think you rationalise your defeats, don't you? I mean, I think the Dutch of 74 always tell themselves they were the true winners of the World Cup because they were the most remembered team. But I think there was a sense that Germany definitely were such good hosts in 2006 that they even stepped aside to let somebody else take away the trophy. And maybe the subsequent development that we've seen wouldn't have happened as gradually and as organically if it already in 2006 they would have won the World Cup. Who knows? We don't know. I think they came pretty close in what was probably, in retrospect, not the greatest of World Cups in terms of qualities and teams around. But more crucially, I think they showed that Germany could play in a different way, could try different things, could play with young players who didn't have that much experience, could play with a different keeper. You know, he axed Oliver Kahn, which was like basically taken to sort to Mother Teresa. I mean, Oliver Kahn was untouchable, and he axed him for Jens Lehmann, a guy who really was not liked at all. But he said, no, I mean, I need to play a high line. I can't have Oliver Kahn, who's afraid to come out of his 6-yard box. And these things now, these days, it's nobody would think twice to, or it's not even a debate that you have a goalkeeper who can play football. I mean, the German school of goalkeeping has changed completely in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Now you see all these guys who are almost trying to do too much on the ball. 2006 was a huge turning point, but I think in a way it just set the stage for what was happening already organically below the surface when it came to the production of younger players. And I think 4 years later, it's no coincidence, in 2010, the first kids who as teenagers had 10 years of proper professional education in the new academies in the Bundesliga, this is the team that then really said, wow, this, okay, 2006 was not flash in a pan. This is a different Germany, and wow. I mean, they're playing a kind of football that we haven't seen from Germany since the 70s, and chances are we haven't seen it at all.
I always thought Mother Teresa was underrated, Rafael. She was definitely weak on crosses.
Reflexes.
Yeah, the reflex. They're one of the great reflex keepers of our generation. Jürgen went on to a difficult, quickly unsuccessful stint at Bayern 2008-2009 that we've discussed. I mean, he became pilloried by the German press in the wake of that. But you wrote something fascinating. I mean, it was actually almost an emotional piece of closure to your book, that the closer this German national team got to winning the 2014 World Cup final, as they went round through round, the greater that same media corps began to review their opinion, and he started to receive massive retrospective accolades for his work and vision, almost as the architect of the thing.
He did, and the amazing thing is that the players, at the moment of winning the World Cup in the Maracanã, thought back to those days. You'd think it's the last thing that a professional player would think back, 10 years to completely different time, different manager. But Lukas Podolski, Bastian Schweinsteiger, they all said, Mertesacker as well, this is the culmination of a 10-year project that started in 2004. So happy to finally deliver, because the fans, we took them so close and disappointed them so many times. It was just, it's something that you cannot, fake. It's not something that they thought about before. It just came out of that moment. And Klinsmann, when I told him that, was hugely proud and almost moved, I think, to listen to it, because he felt, these are my boys, and they kind of got it, all the stuff that I told them, that maybe at the time that they were saying, let him talk, he's the coach, whatever. When it comes to the mental preparation, when it comes to maximizing your potential, I think 2014, not only did Germany have now the squad and the team deep enough to win a competition, which they didn't quite have before, but also I think mentally, they were in a space where every single player was 100% tuned in into the idea of being a team, into the idea of doing whatever is necessary to be successful here. And they hadn't, I think, quite reached that stage at earlier tournaments. And you can't quantify it, of course, but I'm sure it gave them one or two extra percentage points that made it in the end possible to win this thing.
So Jürgen Klinsmann as a system builder, everything. Jürgen Klinsmann as a tactician, much less.
I don't know what's happened since. I cannot really speak with any great authority on Jürgen Klinsmann post-2009. I haven't seen enough games, and I certainly haven't seen enough games live.
Oh, you've been missing out, Rafael, let me tell you.
Yeah, because even on television, I think it's very hard to see what a team is actually doing, because you only see the guy with the ball, maybe three or four. So I don't like to judge teams necessarily if I haven't really seen them much, so I can't tell you. I can tell you that I think in 2006, 2004, he was very much aware of his limitations. Everybody says, when you listen to them, Joachim Löw and Bierhoff, they say that Jürgen Klinsmann has hugely developed as a coach since, that he's no longer just the big motivator, the guy with the big idea. Certainly before the game in Recife, everybody was very complimentary, and again, it felt genuine. I think you can tell when somebody is just paying lip service, or people actually saying, no, this guy is now much more of a manager than he probably was in 2006, or more of a coach, I should say. But I still can't tell you whether that is enough. And I still think that he's hugely reliant on the number two. I remember Andreas Herzog from his playing days. I remember him being throttled by Oliver Kahn during a game on the pitch. Huge hint. YouTube clip. If you haven't seen it, dig it out. It's great. Oliver Kahn gets very upset because Herzog doesn't mark his man and runs 30 meters outside and grabs him by the throat and shakes him up. But whether he's a good coach, I simply don't know. You have to tell me.
I'm not going to. We'll discuss offline, but I will say, reading between the lines, when I shut your book, I did suddenly get a tiny bit excited about the notion of Julian Green, Fabian Johnson and John Brooks lifting the World Cup in 2022. I think that's ultimately the takeaway message that I got from your book. But the most striking fact that has stayed with me, and I love this, in German you wrote, confidence and its antonym, self-consciousness, are the same word. I'm going to bastardize it here. What is it? Selbstbewusstsein.
Selbstbewusstsein.
Oh, you wrote, we don't see the contradiction. To be aware of yourself is to be confident.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the nice thing, I think, when you can change between languages, because the words themselves tell a story sometimes. And I think this is one incident where, you know, you just say confidence or awareness is the same as certainly in England, I don't know about the US, but in English, the idea of somebody being self-conscious is always implying a level of anxiety or angst, you know, or insecurity. Whereas, as I said, the equivalent of the German word is saying, well, that's the best thing, you know, to be conscious of yourself, because then you know that you're going to be okay. And German football, I think, has been over the years, despite one or two blips, I think one of the masters in just harnessing that self-confidence that most footballers have, whatever, you know, wherever they play. You don't really make it as a footballer without that confidence. But I think Germans have managed to take that and then multiply that, magnify it when it comes to playing at the international stage, whereas other nations, maybe your native, England being one of them, I'm not 100% sure, tend to shrivel a little bit under the spotlight.
I think you've lived there long enough now, Raphael, to be 100% sure of that. But Selbstbewusstsein, people, listeners, Selbstbewusstsein, everybody. One last quick one. Bayern Munich, they'll have the league wrapped up by when? And the Champions League, just handicap. How you think that's going to play out for them, Raphael?
Well, I think there is a sense that this is now or never. It's Pep's third year. Everybody's staying fit, knock on wood. No big injuries at the moment. They have to keep that momentum, that rhythm going into the new year. Hopefully Dortmund will keep at them, will make sure that they stay sharp in the league. And then it comes down, as it always does, you know, to a semi-final in March, April. And that is very, very hard, even for the best teams. As we've seen with Barcelona, as we've seen with Real Madrid, I guarantee that every year you're going to be at your very best going into those two key games. So looking at the squad, looking at the way they're playing, you say they're better than last year, they're better the year before. They're probably better than 2013, but it's only November. You know, they have to produce in 6 months' time, and 6 months is a long time. I hope they can do it. I hope Pep will leave with a big legacy, because if you ask the guys, the players, or the board members who can see the training from their offices at Siebener Straße, they will all tell you, on or off the record, this guy is the best coach who's ever worked at Bayern. They have never seen a guy work like that and get that much out of a team. But of course, for the casual viewer, for somebody who only tunes in to the semi-final Champions League, if they get beaten by whatever scoreline, they'll think Pep is a failure. But in Munich, they don't think so. Let's hope that he can have the sending off, I think, that he deserves.
Oh, you've been listening to Raphael Honigstein, the author of Das Reboot, How German Football Reinvented Itself and Conquered the World. Its second subtitle, which I'm now making up, is How American Football Can Reinvent Itself and Conquer the World at World Cup 2022. But it is a remarkable blueprint for transformation and glory. I cannot recommend it highly enough. Raphael Honigstein, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me.